Well, Mother's Day, of course, is a day to celebrate our mothers, to celebrate motherhood, to honor mothers. And it's also a time to celebrate and honor those who have been like a mother to us. I'm always reminded on Mother's Day that the Apostle Paul, when he wrote to the Christians in Rome, and he sent them all kinds of greetings, personal greetings at the very end of that letter, one of the things he said was, he said, "Greet Rufus." And then he said, "Also greet his mother and mine." Now, Paul and Rufus were not brothers, but it's clear that Paul identified Rufus's mother as someone who had mothered him. And so he greets her as such. And I think it's important to remember that there are people who have mothered us. And I know I, for one, my mother passed away 18 years ago, and I've had many people in this congregation who have mothered me. And I appreciate those women very much. And I've also been a pastor long enough to know that Mother's Day can be a very painful day for a lot of women. And I guess there are a lot of reasons for that, but maybe the one word that sums up the reason is the word loss. For some moms, and for some of you who aren't moms, this day sort of represents for you loss. There's the loss, perhaps, of not being able to have children. There's the loss of miscarriage, or even of abortion. There's the loss of having had a child pass away, perhaps from an illness or from an accident. There's the loss of seeing your children grow up and then leave the house. There's the loss of innocence as you watch a child grow up and make choices that are bad choices and harmful choices for them. Over the years, I've observed that motherhood, maybe like a lot of things in life, really is bittersweet. There are joys and sorrows. But I've also found that in the midst of those losses, mothers often demonstrate remarkable tenacity and remarkable strength and remarkable faith. And today I want us to look at an Old Testament story that illustrates that. If you have a Bible, turn to the book of Ruth. It's right after Judges in your Old Testament. This story actually takes place in the period of the Judges. It was really a dark time in the history of Israel. Sort of the theme verse of Judges, of course, is that it was a period of time when every person did what was right in their own eyes. They didn't do what was right in God's eyes. They did what was right in their own eyes. And the results of that are always devastating. But the story of Ruth really is kind of a ray of light in a sea of darkness. Because the story of Ruth really shows off the tenacity and the strength and the faith of two women in particular in the midst of tragedy and loss. And it starts out as they experience this loss. And we're just going to start by reading verses 1 through 5. If you don't have a Bible, the words will be up on the screen. So let's start. "Now it came about in the days when the judges governed that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the land of Moab with his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi, and the name of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem in Judah. Now they entered the land of Moab, and they remained there. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They took for themselves Moabite women as wives. The name of the one was Orpah." That's not Oprah, that's Orpah. "And the name of the other, Ruth. And they lived there about 10 years. Then Mahlon and Chilion also died, and the woman was bereft of her two children and her husband." So the narrator, the writer of Ruth, begins by describing the migration of a certain man from Bethlehem in Judah to Moab. He isn't identified by name until verse 2, and his name is Elimelech. He, along with his wife, Naomi, and their two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, are described as Ephrathites of Bethlehem in Judah. Which, for those who were reading this story years later, would be a signal, because this was a way of saying that they were part of the royal family. Because every Jew knew that David would come out of this same family. They would have made about a 40-mile trek east to the area just across the Dead Sea. And we're told that he moved his family because of a famine in the land of Judah, which of course is an indication of God's judgment upon them. Most of us, of course, have never experienced famine. Maybe we've seen some of those terrible photos and pictures that we see on television, and we have a sense of just what a terrible thing famine must be. You can understand why Elimelech would move his family from the promised land to this strange land of Moab. One of the things, though, we need to understand is that in the context of the Old Testament, this would be viewed as a faithless move on Elimelech's part. Instead of trusting God to provide in the land, he moved his family to a nation that historically had been opposed to God's people. The Moabite race was the result of the incestuous union between Lot's children. The Moabite religion was diametrically opposed to the worship of the one true God. The Moabites worshipped a god named Chemosh, a false god who, by the way, expected the Moabites to sacrifice some of their children as burnt offerings. So this is what Elimelech is exposing his family to. And perhaps that is why tragedy struck. First, Elimelech dies, leaving Naomi a single mother in a strange land. As a widow, she would have no way of providing for herself until her boys grew up and could take care of her. We don't know how much time passed, but eventually her two sons took Moabite wives, Ruth and Orpah, and they settled there in Moab for about 10 years. But as if one tragedy wasn't enough, Naomi's two sons then died as well. I mean, this is hard to even imagine. I can't imagine the devastation of losing one child, much less two. But there's a kind of pathos behind the words that we see in verse 5. It says, and the woman, the narrator can't even say her name at this point, and the woman was bereft of her two children and her husband. A lot of emotion behind those words. Besides the emotional toll this must have taken upon Naomi and her daughters-in-law, there was a practical side as well to this, especially for Naomi. Now Naomi was totally helpless. She didn't even have her sons to take care of her. There's no social security system back then. There's no life insurance policies to fall back on. So you can't help but feel for Naomi, because she's probably too old to remarry. She doesn't even have grandchildren. She must have been overwhelmed with grief, loneliness, fear, and an utter sense of hopelessness. What would she do? What at this point in her life would Naomi live for? It must have crossed her mind. Why should I even go on? Why should I even keep doing this? What is there for me to live for? Now, I realize for some of us it might be difficult to identify with Naomi. I mean, we've had a few problems. All of us have. But few of us have had problems of this magnitude. Our life may have even gone relatively smooth up until now. But there are people here this morning who know exactly what Naomi must have felt like, because you've lost a child. You've lost a parent, a friend, a brother, or a sister. Maybe you've been left all alone. It doesn't have to be a death. There are a lot of losses we can experience. Maybe not quite as painful as Naomi's, but painful nonetheless. There's the loss of divorce. There's illness or even the loss of a job. The fact is, all of us have to deal with loss at some level in our lives. Nobody is exempt from this in life at all. Everyone's turn comes sooner or later. And God's people, God's followers, are not exempt either. And sometimes all of it comes at once, as it did with Naomi. Have you ever had that experience where you get hit with one thing? And then just when you're starting to recover from that thing, something else hits you. And then maybe even something else. And it's like wave upon wave upon wave keeps crashing upon you until you just don't even know if you can go on. It's interesting, though, how sometimes these losses have a way of bearing fruit in our life. I heard a story this week that I think illustrates this about a woman, a mother, who back in 1992 was notified by the police chief in Beattyville, Kentucky, that her two teenage sons had been killed in an automobile accident. Her name was Rosemary Smith. Her husband's Luther. And the boys were coming back from a concert in Indianapolis, and their vehicle was struck and they were killed. Of course, darkness like never before experienced in her life sort of descended upon Rosemary at that point. And yet she was a believer, and she found solace in her faith, and she took her refuge in God. And she tells this story that on the way to the funeral site, she was in the car in one of those funeral processions, and she said that she heard a bell ring, church bells ring, 33 times. And she said, actually, let me quote her. She said, "As I sat there and counted it, it hit me that Jesus died when he was 33, which was also the combined ages of my two sons." And then not long after her loss, Rosemary began a group called Fellow Travelers, which was a ministry to other parents who had lost a child as she had. And so every day she reads the newspapers, she searches the internet for child obituaries. And when she finds one, she either calls that family or she sends them a special packet with books and CDs and a letter of encouragement just to minister to them. Now, almost 15 years later, she gets about 50 emails a day from people requesting her packets. She and her husband have paid for and sent more than 5,000 packets all over the world. And here's what she says. "I feel this is my mission on earth. I now have a higher purpose than what I was doing. And it was the death of my sons that took me there." One writer puts it this way. "The experience of loss itself doesn't need to be the defining moment of our lives. Instead, the defining moment can be our response to that loss. We don't have the freedom to choose the roles we must play in life, but we can choose how we're going to play the roles we've been given." Did you hear that? Because that's a great line. We don't have the freedom to choose the roles we must play in life, but we can choose how we're going to play the roles we've been given. As we read the rest of chapter 1, we're going to see that this was true not just for Naomi, but for her two daughters-in-law as well. Because each of these women had important choices to make in the face of their loss. And in their initial response to their loss, they teach us about the choices that we have to make in the midst of loss as well. How to survive it, but also how to grow through it. As a matter of fact, the first thing Naomi does in response to all this is make a choice. Look at verse 6. "Then she," that is Naomi, "arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the land of Moab, for she had heard in the land of Moab that the Lord had visited his people in giving them food." So Naomi makes a decision to return home. And the reason she decides to return home, the writer tells us, is that she heard the Lord had visited his people in providing food. So the famine's over. This is not a story, by the way, that has a lot of overt miracles in it. But here God pops his head up And we see that God is providing food again for His people. And we know that God is the one who provides food. After a famine, they probably know that a little more than ever. And we go to the refrigerator and we think that, you know, the supermarket provides food, or the farmers provide food, or whatever. Or In-N-Out provides food. I don't know. But I don't want to talk too much about food because you're getting hungry. But God is the one who provides food. And Naomi hears that God is providing food back home. How she heard, we do not know. But you get the feeling here, this is an important decision, and maybe Naomi will turn a corner. Maybe better things are ahead for Naomi. But I want you to know that the choice for Naomi to return was an important choice. It reveals her courage, it reveals her stubborn will to live, and it reveals her faith. And it strikes me that sometimes in the midst of hopelessness and loss and grief, the hardest thing to do is to do something, to take any small step in the direction of life. Sometimes that's the very hardest thing to do. To take a step in the direction of receiving blessing again from God. Sometimes, if we're honest, we're paralyzed by loss. We're paralyzed by grief. We want to hang on to the last remnants of our past. Sometimes in our depression, we lack the energy and will to do anything at all. We just want to give up. We just want to keep nurturing our losses. And sometimes, if we're honest, ruthlessly honest, we want to wallow in self-pity. I'm not saying that we should run away from the pain. As we're going to see in a minute, Naomi took the pain with her. But she made a decision for life. And she made a decision to receive life again from God. And I think that in the midst of our losses, we have to make decisions. For you, it might be a decision that you're going to get help. Maybe you're going to go see a Christian counselor. Or maybe you're just going to come to church. Or maybe you're going to join a small group of other people who have been through similar things that you've been through. It might be just a decision to get out of bed in the morning. Sometimes that's the best you can do. It might be a decision to buy yourself a new dress. It might be a decision to go out and really look for a job. Whatever it is, God will give you the strength to make that first choice, to take that first step in the direction of life. Some of you are right there, and you're contemplating giving up. You're contemplating just it's over. I'm done. And I encourage you to take one step in the direction of life, like Naomi did. The second thing we can learn from these women has to do with their relationship with one another. There's something about shared suffering that kind of knits your heart together. And we see that here. So let's start reading in verse 7. It says that, "So she," that is Naomi, "departed from the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, 'Go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt kindly with the dead and with me. May the Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband.' Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, 'No, but we will surely return with you to your people.' But Naomi said, 'Return, my daughters, why should you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb, that they may be your husbands? Return, my daughters, go, for I am too old to have a husband, even if I have hope. If I should even have a husband tonight and also bear sons, would you therefore wait until they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it's harder for me than for you, and for the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me.' And they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her." When Naomi heads off for Israel, Ruth and Orpah leave with her. Now, you should know it was customary back then for people, as they were saying goodbye, to walk partway with them. We do this today as we maybe walk someone out to their car. So it was normal at first for them just to walk for a while with Naomi. But after a while, it's clear that these women were not saying goodbye. They were not turning back to Moab. And Naomi wants them to stay in Moab because from her perspective, they have a better future in Moab. And so she wants them to stay there. There, they could find a husband. That's why she says to them, "Return to your mother's house." It was in the mother's home that marriages were arranged. This was a way of saying, "Listen, go back and let your mother arrange for you another marriage, and you'll live happily ever after." So she has a genuine concern for her daughters-in-law. That's why she also prays for them. "May the Lord deal kindly with you." By the way, that word "kindly" is a very important pregnant Hebrew word. It's the word hesed. And it's a word throughout the Old Testament that refers to God's loyal, committed, faithful love for His people. The New Testament counterpart for that word is the word agape. So may the Lord's hesed be with you as you go back to Moab, she says. But then they refuse to go back home. And so Naomi really tightens up her argument even more. She says, "Have I yet sons in my womb that they might be your husbands?" Now you might wonder, what in the world is she talking about here? But back in the Old Testament, there was a custom, there was a law, and it was called the law of the Levirate. And basically what it meant was that if your husband died as a woman, then one of his brothers would marry you. And that was a way of carrying on the dead husband's name and passing on the dead husband's land. Because the child that came from your union with that brother would take the name of the dead husband. And his land would be passed on to that child. It's called the law of the Levirate. And so Naomi, in essence, says, "Listen, even if I were to get a husband at my age, even if we were to get together tonight, fat chance," she says, "and even if we were to have another son or sons, are you going to wait around for them to grow up?" Doesn't make a lot of sense, right? That's her argument. I think it's a rather cynical and sarcastic way of thinking on Naomi's part, but it's true. Orpah buys it, and she goes back to Moab. And really, don't blame her. She really did the normal expected thing in that culture. But Ruth does not buy it. And Ruth does the unexpected, out of the ordinary thing. We're told that she clings to Naomi like a 2-year-old whose mother is trying to get her in the nursery over there, and she just clings to her neck. So Ruth is clinging to Naomi. And Naomi even tries to exert a little peer pressure on Ruth. "Look at Orpah. She went back. Go with her." She even brings a little spiritual element into it. She's gone back to her people and her what? Gods. "Go back to your gods," she says. But Ruth refuses to budge. Look at verse 15. "Then Ruth said, 'Behold,'" or excuse me, this is not Ruth, this is Naomi. "Naomi said, 'Behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. Return after your sister-in-law.' But Ruth said, 'Do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me and worse if anything but death parts you and me.' When she saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more to her." I think Ruth's expression of loyal love to Naomi are some of the most beautiful words in all the Bible. We hear them at weddings occasionally. They're really not marriage words, as you can see here from the story, but they certainly fit a marriage, no doubt about it. But these words have to do with friendship between two women. Ruth's expressing her undying loyalty to her mother-in-law, as her mother-in-law and as her friend. She says that she will even be buried in that land. And that's a big thing in that culture. Where you're buried is a big deal. And so she says, listen, I'm cutting all ties. I'm going to be buried in Israel. I'm going to be buried in your land. Why would she do that? Because ultimately, this was an expression not just of her loyalty to her mother-in-law, but of her loyalty to who? To the Lord, you see. That's why she says, your God will be my God. This is really a conversion story, if you will. She had learned about this God, of course, from Naomi. And after all that had happened to Naomi, she might have thought, listen, if that's how your God treats his friends, I think I'll pass. But no, she had come to see and believe in him, and now her faith in God is expressed in leaving everything behind. Don't forget that Ruth had taken some shots too. Ruth had lost a husband. Ruth had been childless for a long time. So her life has not been easy either. But she expresses unusual faith and loyalty. And so we learn here that if we're going to survive loss, we have to learn this kind of deep loyalty to one another. We have to make a choice that we're going to look out for each other's interest. We have to make a decision that we are going to cling to one another as brothers and sisters in Christ. Our tendency in these times is to do what? It's to isolate ourselves, right? That's generally what we do. But we learn here that we need to extend ourselves to each other. And the church ought to be a place where we demonstrate that it is possible to have non-sexual relationships of great depth and intimacy and commitment. And I don't think I have to tell you that we live in a rootless, mobile, transient society. Neighborhoods and workplaces are in constant flux. We rarely get to know our neighbors. How many of us really know our next door neighbors? Our workplaces are arenas of cutthroat competition. And so there are a few places where friendship can really blossom. Sex offers a momentary connection without the commitment. So people often exchange that for genuine friendship. But here in the book of Ruth, we see a non-sexual relationship of extraordinary commitment and intimacy between two single women. And there are people in our society who, for one reason or another, sometimes by choice, will never marry. But that does not exclude them from experiencing chesed, from experiencing loyal and intimate love. And if you're single, I challenge you to forge those kinds of relationships. You may have felt like you've been kind of scratched from the guest list when it comes to having those kind of relationships. But that's a lie. Look around you. Here's a question I would ask you. Is there a Ruth for you to look out for, like Naomi looked out for Ruth? Is there someone that God is calling you in the midst of loss for you to extend yourself to? Or I would ask you, is there a Naomi for you to cling to? Is there someone in your life that you need to just wrap your hands around their neck and say, I'm clinging to you no matter what, because I'm not going to make it any other way? So off they go. Ruth and Naomi make the journey back to Israel, across the mountains, into the little town of Bethlehem. And we read of their arrival, starting in verse 19. Let's read. So they both went until they came to Bethlehem. And when they had come to Bethlehem, all the city was stirred because of them. And the women said, is this Naomi? She said to them, do not call me Naomi, call me Mara. For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi? Since the Lord has witnessed against me and the Almighty has afflicted me. So they're walking back into Bethlehem. We can kind of imagine the buzz around the town as news passes from house to house that Naomi's back. And the woman of the town, they sort of whisper to one another as they look at Naomi walk through the town for the first time in years. Is this Naomi? Is this her? I don't think they were mocking her. I think they were glad to see her after 20 years, but we can hear the disbelief in their voices. We can only guess the story that Naomi's face told. She'd left with a husband and two sons. Now she returns with no one but a Moabite woman. And so Naomi responds with a bitter complaint. By the way, Naomi means pleasant. Mara means bitter. Our name Mary or Marie comes from that. It means bitter. She says, "Don't call me pleasant. Call me bitter." That's what she says. And then she attributes all her suffering to the hand of God. She says, "The Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. I went out full, but the Lord has brought me back empty." Now, this is what the Bible calls a lament. In modern translation, it's called a complaint. Okay? Now, we're not very comfortable with this. What would you say if someone in your small group Bible study all of a sudden piped up and said, "You know what? God has dealt bitterly with me." "Oh, no way. Don't say that. I mean, it's not God's fault." We don't talk like this very often. We might feel like Naomi was very unspiritual to talk this way. But you need to know this was not the first or the last time God's people have lodged a complaint with God. She is in great company. She's in company with Jeremiah, Job, Moses, and David. They all knew how to lament in the presence of God. And I, for one, believe God appreciates the honesty. Often we think God is offended by our questions or our complaints. Often we think that, but when you're intimate with someone, when there's a deep relationship of trust, then it's normal to express your personal feelings when you feel betrayed. It's normal. Now, I believe this can cross a line into sin where we become deeply resentful and where we fail to continue our trust of God. In an almost paradoxical way, our choice to face and lament our pain is necessary before we can really experience joy again. And that's what she does. So don't deny the pain. If you're in pain, if you're grieving a loss, don't deny it. That's not the answer here. Lament it. Bring it to God. Cry out to God. And share it with others, as we've seen. Part of the reason she complained to God is that she had a strong belief that God was really in charge of all life. Remember how Jesus said, "Listen, don't worry about anything. God the Father has counted the hairs on your head. So he doesn't let anything happen to you apart from his hand." And she believed that. And that's faith. She says, "The Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. The Lord has brought me back empty." So what happened to her was not random. It feels random, doesn't it, when stuff like this happens? But it's not. Naomi believed that God was in charge. She believed in what we call the sovereignty of God. She believed that. But what she had a hard time seeing at this point is that God was indeed at work in all of these things for her good and for his glory. And at this point in the story, she cannot see it. She says, "The hand of the Lord is against me." It was not against her. It was not against her. It seemed that way. And it seems at times in our life like the hand of the Lord is against us, doesn't it? But it is not against us. It is for us. And it is a huge battle of faith, I think, to believe that. And God would use this in her life, if we know the story of Naomi. God would use this in her life for amazing blessing. That's what she had yet to learn. That's what the rest of the story of Ruth is about. Notice she says, "I went out full, but the Lord has brought me back empty." Look at the very last verse of this chapter. "So Naomi returned and with her Ruth, the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, who returned from the land of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. So look at that verse. Remember, Naomi says, I went out full, but I came back totally empty-handed. Now read verse 22. And I ask you, is she empty-handed? What does she have? She has Ruth. She has this stubborn Moabite woman who was willing to go all the way back and commit her whole life to her. She has that. And what does she have? She has a barley harvest. She has this kind of hint from the narrator that better things are to come. And so in the midst of our losses, it is an act of faith for us to believe that God is still at work and His ultimate aim is to bless us. All we can see is the loss. All we can feel is the pain. But if we open our eyes, maybe we have a loyal friend clinging to us like Ruth. Maybe there's a barley harvest on the horizon. And maybe the most important choice we can make is one step in the direction of life. I want to close this morning, not like I normally do with a prayer, but I want to close this morning by sharing a story with you about a young woman, a young mother named Heidi. And I was introduced to her this week, and she's going to tell her story on the screen for you. And it's a story about a woman who made a choice for life in the midst of a great loss. In her case, what her loss was her own future with her children and with her husband. So let's watch this.
My name's Heidi, and I'm married to Mark, and we've been married 11 years. I have a son, Jacob, who's 10, and a son, Sam, is 7. In November of last year, I was diagnosed with myelodysplastic syndrome, and it's a bone marrow failure disease that will eventually kill you, with the only cure being a bone marrow transplant. So at the time being, I'm waiting for a donor. I just had an upset stomach for a few days, and then it kind of turned into a couple of weeks, and finally, at Mark's urging, I went to the doctor. They did some routine blood work, and the blood work just sort of kept coming back awkward and anemic is what it kept showing. Within about a week, I had my first bone marrow biopsy, and that came back with the myelodysplasia or myelodysplastic syndrome, and so that was sort of the start of all the chaos of realizing that this disease was a lot bigger than we thought. For me, the hardest thing was to see each day and each thing our kids did or each dinner, every single thing I was doing just on a normal day, I was thinking at that time, will this be the last time I ever see this happen? I think God was really calling out to me at that point to say, you know, here it is, hold it in your hand, the preciousness of all that I've given you. But then He met me in that deepest, darkest point and said, okay, so now go and live, because no matter what the doctors tell me and Mark and our family and our friends, I'm still responsible for today. And I can't take away this illness. I can't take a magic pill and make it go away. I can't know what I'm going to find out tomorrow from a doctor, but I can choose life today. We all have something in our life that God is calling us to bring Him glory through. Sometimes it's really great, and He wants us to bring glory through wealth and success and joy, and then sometimes it's darkness, and it's deep, and it's painful, and it doesn't make sense. And of course, I don't want this, but this is the journey that God's allowed us to be on, that He's said, okay, here it is, how are you going to glorify me? And so that's where I put my focus. If I turn around and I put my focus on myself or what I may not have or what I may miss out on the future, then it's not bringing God glory and it doesn't do what He's calling me to do, which is focus entirely on Him on every moment. Philippians 1:20 says, I eagerly expect and hope that I will in no way be ashamed, but will have sufficient courage so that now as always, Christ will be exalted in my body, whether by life or by death. There's nothing I can do to take away the sadness except to release it to God, because in that sadness, he's creating me and changing me into the person he wants me to be in the midst of this illness. God just sort of squished me and said, you know, look at me in the face and know that no matter where you go and what you see and what pain you feel and what loss you feel, I will always be here for you. There's no hope without Christ. So my hope and my power and my strength and my courage can only come from him. If what this disease is a way for people to move themselves out of where they are to say, okay, God, I don't really understand you. You're bigger than what I know. But somehow I want to know you better. I want to figure out what this thing is all about. Then it's all worth it. If one person comes to Christ because of this, then it's worth it.